Expanding Mind with Eric Davis, Thursdays at 2 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. Metalhead or into magic or whatever, people are going to come across the name and the work of Crowley. And, I guess we had some problems there with the, how are we doing now on the thing? Okay, sorry about that. Anyway, as I was saying, there was a I kind of made the discovery that in a lot of ways that after Crowley's death, in many ways the most important place on the planet for the propagation, interpretation, expression, exploration of his ideas and practices through Thelema and the OTO really occurred in California. And this was significant to me because I really have strong belief in this kind of central role that California has played, particularly in the late 19th and 20th centuries, in the kind of creation and establishment of, in many ways, our curious, half post-human, half mystical condition here as we plunge into a very, very strange century. And that it really is kind of perfect that that California was the site of so much, sort of keeping Crowley's work alive when it was not very well known, and then in bringing it up to the kind of high pitch of notoriety that it achieved in the early 70s, and it stayed with us ever since because. There's a kind of intensity to the California countercultural experience, positive and negative, a willingness to run risks, to embrace the body, embrace sexuality, embrace psychoactives, embrace extreme states. And in many ways, Crowley prophesied this sort of approach, this kind of anarchic, sometimes hedonistic approach to spiritual experience in a kind of prophetic way. And so it was very interesting to kind of discover for me that came late in looking at it just because I didn't know that much about the history of the OTO and Thelema before, more recent times. Anyway, that's all a long way of saying one of the reasons that I'm very happy to have our on the show today, our guest, Lon Duquette, who I'm sure many of you know, who is not only a very well-established and quite entertaining public representative of a lot of the streams of esoteric exploration and experience that Crowley represented, as well as other streams, Asian and other magical traditions. But he's also a Californian, or at least basically a Californian, which just makes me very happy. But before we bring on Lon, I want to bring on another Californian, or basically a Californian, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dao. You there, Maja?
I totally am. How's it going?
That's good. I'm always glad. I'm always afraid there's going to be, like, I guess I had some weird technological connection problem earlier, and I never know if you're actually there until you speak. So I'm really relieved.
Don't be scared.
So what's, I mean, you're not that far away from, like, JPL, right? Like, that whole,
in fact,
like, weird epicenter of California bizarreness.
We're very close. In fact, I just was talking to a JPL rocket scientist shortly who was attending an I Ching seminar, if you can believe that. He was a very cool dude. I won't mention his name lest he get in trouble with his higher-ups, but he was, like, this rad dude with sideburns, and he had, like, a leather vest with fringes. I mean, he looked like straight out of the 70s. So it's funny you were mentioning the impact of the 70s. But he was a total Crowleyan dude that works at JPL on rockets, and he was there at an I Ching seminar. So it was awesome.
That's wonderful. A little bit of a sociological datum there for us.
Yes, yes.
Very good. Well, let me bring on Lon Duquette. Lon, thanks so much for joining us here on Expanding Mind.
For having me on.
Excellent.
You were cutting out on us there for a little while.
I know. I don't know what happened. It seems to be okay now. It's very nerve wracking. But, you know, technology is not always our friend.
Well, I know. Even my landline phone here has been kind of scratchy lately too. And I've got my cell phone here in case case that acts up again, we can reconnect. But anyway, I don't know. I am a Californian. I was born in Long Beach.
Oh, I thought you were born elsewhere and moved. I'm sorry. I was clearly not reading close enough.
Well, that's okay. I moved to Nebraska when I was, 7 years old.
That's what it was.
Yeah. And, boy, talk about culture shock. It took me 10 years to get out of that place.
Wow.
Oh, wow. So you
to tell you the truth, I think that's
there.
Where my mysticalness started, though, because I was so miserable in Nebraska that every night, I'm not exaggerating, every night I prayed to flying saucer people to come and get me the hell out of Nebraska. I said, you can even perform medical experiments on me. I don't care. Just get me out of Nebraska.
Well, how about that? Do you think that in some ways that if you had been in a more pleasant situation at that very ripe time of life, I mean, a lot of occult stuff, a lot of mystical things begin in sort of early in adolescence, early teenagedom, partly because of the alienating conditions. I mean, in retrospect, can you almost see that was like a kind of boon?
Yeah, a magical blessing in disguise, I guess we could. We could call it, because it really made me appreciate. Don't get me wrong, Nebraskans are just beautiful people that give you the shirt off their backs. But the harshness of the environment just kind of puts them on a survival. You know, mental track, and there's not much romance and subtlety and magic and so it's such a desert in a way of spirituality that it makes you yearn to be progressive and yearn to be free So who knows if I would have stayed in California and what could have happened. But anyway, I'm here now. I'm back.
So since your latest book, Low Magic, does include some really interesting autobiographical pieces and memoirs, why don't you talk about a little bit your mystical awakening when you were a teenage person? For me, it's one of the most interesting things to ask people who have devoted themselves to these peculiar pursuits is, like, when things begin, because they often announce themselves in really interesting ways.
Well, they for me, they announced themselves very, very early. I had... just when I was starting to walk, I was limping around instead of walking, and they took me to the doctor because, of course, they were afraid it was polio. This is like 1950. I was 2 years old. And so they discovered I didn't have polio, but I had a bone disease called, which they call Perthes hip disease. And there's no cure for it, except just hopefully a person outgrows it. And so they put me back in the crib and said, took me completely off my feet. I couldn't walk, wasn't allowed to walk or put any weight on my hip for a few years. And it really, just as I was starting to talk and walk and lose those the infantile pre-linguistic memories that people have, I was allowed to go back into the crib and just let those pre-linguistic infantile memories crystallize. And that's where I started having experiences of other lives, memories of other lives. And I talk about that in the book. I also wrote another book about 10 years ago called My Life with the Spirits. And I sort of go into that a lot. But one of those.
It's funny, I can't help but be reminded of the limping god. You know, Eric, didn't you write that really good article about, like, the limping god throughout different cultures? And, I mean, in China, it's like Yu the Great. And that's, like, the image of someone who has one foot in the real world and one foot in the spirit world is literally represented by limping a lot of times.
Oh, that is so cool. Well, that's really what it was, is because when you're allowed to drift in and out of consciousness 24 hours a day. See, I didn't sleep, 8 hours and was awake 8 hours. I was asleep for 10 minutes and I was awake for 10 minutes, and I just drifted in and out. So literally, I had one foot in another state at all times, and it gave me an appreciation for that aspect of my consciousness. It made it sort of second nature to be my dream world was real, and my real world was a dream, you know.
How did that help you or sort of affect your, you know, like your teen years? You know, you're in this weird place and you've already opened up these other realms, and you have did it like alienate you? Did it help the alienation? Did it actually help you see life as a kind of play that you could play with?
Well, every teenager, no matter what their background, feels like they're an alien. So I don't know. I don't know whether I felt any more alienated than my fellows, but I was a California kid in Nebraska, and so already I had I was at both an advantage and a disadvantage, you know, among my peers. Everyone thought that I was weird always, so I got used to dealing with being weird, but I did it in a very pleasant way. I became like the class clown, and I got into music almost as soon as they could, you know, put a instrument in my hand, and I was always in the choirs and the school musicals and things like that. And I guess today they would say I had ADD, because if something just didn't stimulate me, if I wasn't passionate about a subject, something in my brain just turned off. So that made study, regular school studies, very difficult for me, because I just wouldn't do it if I wasn't if I wasn't completely turned on about a subject, I didn't
You're
do anything.
Bored.
Yeah, I was totally bored.
Well, that's understandable. So I'm kind of curious to hear you, you know, riff a little bit about California and whether you talk about your own, you know, your first encounter of kind of the mystery traditions and what the scene was like when you were there, or just even on a more broad level, kind of the role that particular culture, at least in the time that you were growing up or a young man, how that kind of plays a role in the larger story of modern occultism or the magical revival.
Well, yes, California, especially Southern California, I don't want to shortchange Northern California for all of its hipness in the San Francisco area, but Southern California, I always, even as a little kid, appreciated the place as if it was a magical realm, like you know, Avalon or Shambhala. I remember my parents making fun of the fact that most of our neighbors had started their own religion. And there were guys running around in turbans, and there were swamis, and we were one of the first people on our block to have a television, and the early television shows here, KTLA in Los Angeles, and you know, brought up the fact and interviewed very eccentric people, the early health food fanatics and yogis and you know, strange people. Not to overlook the fact that rock and roll was starting. It wasn't even called rock and roll. It was it was called a number of things, but they called it double meaning no name jive for a while.
Sounds like a good genre. I think I could listen to some more of that.
Yeah, and my brother is 6 years older than I. So and he was sort of like my idol and my mentor, and so I got in on you know, the birth of rock and roll, and for me there wasn't I couldn't differentiate between the magic of rock and roll and the magic of Southern California weird religion, weird spirituality things. It was all one and the same to me, and it's very strange. I didn't know it at the time, but we lived in Lakewood, which is a part of Long Beach, and even while I was living in Lakewood between 1948 and 1956. Just down the street from us, I think just like two blocks down the street, the OTO, the remnants of the OTO, met, of the last remnants of the Southern California OTO, met and had a very historical meeting with Carl Germer and Grady McMurtry and Helen Smith and all of the surviving Southern California members of Agape Lodge had a real historic meeting as to whether to start initiating again. And at the meeting, they decided to follow Carl Germer's recommendation that they don't initiate, at least while he was alive. And you know, when I grew up and joined the OTO and found out about that historic meeting, I said, well, that happened like two blocks from my house. I probably rode my tricycle by that meeting. Yeah.
That's beautiful. That's the kind of synchronicity I was looking for with all my probing questions. I mean, there's so many things to talk about, but since I'm also a rock fan, and I've actually heard some of the tracks from the old Epic records when you were Milo.
Yeah.
And just a little bit about rock and roll, but particularly the part you talk about in your book in Low Magic about how, in a way, like how you left rock and roll, that, or at least that lifestyle, because you kept playing music, but like you left that lifestyle, very interesting place that also says something about your kind of spiritual evolution and stuff. So I'd love to hear a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, when I was in Nebraska, of course, like almost every other boy my age, I played the guitar and wanted to be in a band. And when I was 14, I was lucky enough to get into a band that actually worked. And we worked every weekend and on some weeknights and traveled all around Nebraska and South Dakota and Iowa and Kansas, and we were pretty good. And by the time I graduated from high school, I was turned on to kind of the folk music renaissance that was happening in the mid '60s, and. So when I moved back to California, the minute I graduated from high school, I mean, I was, the sheepskin was still hot, and I was back to California, and I was really lucky. And I guess I say in the book, and it's not an exaggeration, I was so unconscious of my own lack of talent that I must have made other people unaware of my lack of talent too, and I got jobs and almost immediately as opening act for Hoyt Axton and over here at the Golden Bear and a couple of clubs, and eventually I teamed up with Charlie Harris and that's where Charlie D and Milo are our band, and we were signed with Epic Records, and we did two singles and an album with Epic. We released two singles and an album, and things were going pretty good for us, but I truly really enjoyed the excesses of the lifestyle of sort of recording artists and rock and roll. I enjoyed partying more than I enjoyed the music. and the music was a wonderful doorway to the partying. And if you know anything about life in those days, the more successful you were, the wilder your lifestyle was. And I had married my high school sweetheart, and we had a little boy just born in 72, and I more or less had to make a decision of what kind of life did I want. And as much as I enjoyed the partying, that was not going to be a healthy thing for my family. And as much as I enjoyed music, I could see that the way I was heading with it right then was not going to be a healthy thing for me. And I literally made the decision to get out of the music business, at least as it stood at the moment, and then do God knows what.
Well, you know, since we're heading up to our mid-hour break, and we're talking about music, you sent us a more recent tune. I think we have Sweet Babylon queued up here. You want to introduce the tune at all, and then we'll hear that, and then go to a break.
Okay. Yeah. This is just me and my guitar, and it's a simple little tune called Sweet Babylon, and recorded it a couple years back, and the song more or less explains itself. So.
Wonderful. All right, so we'll hear Sweet Babylon, and then we'll go to a break and come back to Expanding Mind.
People keep saying that Jesus is Lord. He'll take me in the rapture. He'll come with a sword. Preachers on TV tell me I'm living wrong. But I've tasted the lips of sweet Babylon. Sweet Babylon, oh heavenly harlot, let down your hair and take me to bed. Hold out your cup and I'll pour the wine. Drink to the night of sweet Babylon. Sacred love, abomination, but dying in your arms is sweeter than salvation. Heaven is the night of sweet Babylon. Sweet Babylon, oh heavenly harlot, lover of all, refuser of none. Out your cup and I'll pour the wine. Drink to the night of sweet Babylon. Heaven is the night of sweet Babylon.
Radio Network, your voice for independent views.
Hey Lee.
Yeah, Jeff.
Your girlfriend gave another interview.
No, don't play it.
Listen to this.
I have a journalism degree. That is what I studied. I understand that this cornerstone of our democracy is a free press.
Shut it off! I said not to play it!
We are in the worst reality show in history.
Why won't she shut up?
You know she's going to be president, right?
Okay, stop it. That's not funny. That's not funny!
I think we should just go limp. Lay back. Maybe then the Mama Grizzly won't tear off your limbs.
Cheater in the Rude. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Progressive Radio Network.
Hello! Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
Is someone driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your life, your relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Standing Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Maja Gawu, and we're here with Eric Davis and Lon Melode Tech. And that was a great song before the break. I truly appreciate it, as I have been called Babylon several times in my life. I was just curious, you know, a lot of people are familiar with your work, maybe, or maybe they're not, but I always appreciate your humor and the amount of yourself that you put into it. And I was wondering if you might be willing to share for folks, like, exactly what it is you do to, like, keep this magicalness about you. You know, I know we've been alluding to Crowley and his works and stuff like that, but what does that mean for you? Like, when you get up in the morning, do you do a ritual? Do you do a divination? Do you use tarot? Or do you, like, reserve that for special occasions? How does that work into your life? Is it interpenetrating, or you just kind of, you know, do it in special places?
Well, no, I don't get up and do ritual. Well, yeah, I guess I do get up and do ritual. I go to the bathroom and do the same, morning routine and stuff. But eat approximately the same time and take a walk approximately the same time. But after a while, in magic, you think of magic as something that you do, but it isn't. If you have any chance of figuring out what magic is, you figure out that magic is something that you are. It's something that you become. And so in short order, once you've sort of gotten into the swing of what it's all about, everything becomes a magical act. Magic just isn't a ritual, and then, say, going to work and making a living is unmagical. No, going to work is making a living. That's a magical act. You're doing magic to do it. You have to do magic to get in the car and drive there. It's not that you do magic, it's that you become a magician. And then once you become a magician, everything you do is magic.
That's like the best answer I've ever heard. And it's so funny you started with saying you go to the bathroom, because actually, like, for me, I lived with a Hasidic Jew for a while, you know, and I became very aware that in part of becoming, like, really truly religious is that every mundane activity is sacred, and you're able to find that in it. And I really agree that that's what being a magician. So, I mean, I think a lot of people think that being a Crowleyan or something like that means that you go off in some dark spot and, like, do these, you know, sex magic rituals or whatever. And I'm just really glad that you answered that, to try and, like, let people know that it's like a state of consciousness, essentially, right?
Right. Right, and the whole idea is to transform yourself to consciously evolve and consciously change, elevate your consciousness. And,
well, here's another question based on that. It's like, that, you know, if we have this this big goal, a lot of people, a lot of spiritual practices work to elevate your consciousness. It's not about specific rituals. Nonetheless, at various points in your path, you have found yourself, doing relatively elaborate ritual processes, at the heart of which is the, let's just put find a part on it, invocation of demons. So what is it about the specific kind of intensity or richness or kind of ritual creativity of the sort of, Western magical tradition, and particularly some of its more, let's say, darker sides, that is helpful for that larger goal that so many people could identify with, whether they're Buddhists or they're Tai Chi people or things where their practices are very different. But talk about the way where those two things meet.
Yes. Well, early on, back in the 70s, I really figured that I was going to be an Eastern mystic. I mean, we belonged to the Self-Realization Fellowship, the Yogananda Yoga group, and I was all set to go the Eastern route, like the Beatles. and I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed everything about it, and it seemed like I was resonating. I found the truth by exploring the Eastern mysticism that I was never ever getting with my exposure up to that point in anything Western, which was Christian. And something that I was completely, disgusted with. And but after a while, I felt that in a way, I was trying to play Eastern software on my Western hardware. And I was built a little different than. I didn't have an Eastern psyche. When I went inside, when I stripped stuff away, I went inside and it was so big inside me that it scared the crap out of me. Okay? I wasn't comfortable going inside. Okay? I scared myself inside. And so I thought, well, surely there must be a Western way, and in the West, the magic and the Western spiritual approach, it seems like we're comfortable with things at least outside of ourselves. We like scripture. We like preachers telling us what to do. We like to work with inner aspects of ourselves, but working with them outside of ourselves, like Kabbalah. Kabbalah is a perfect example. With Kabbalah, you literally try to connect everything in the universe with absolutely everything else. See, it's just the opposite of the Eastern approach, where you strip away everything. One by one until there's nothing left to strip away. But in the West, like Kabbalah, you connect everything in the universe with everything else until there's nothing left to connect. Both approaches, one is divine emptiness and one is divine fullness, and the emptiness and the fullness is exactly the same thing. You just go about getting there a little bit differently.
No, I remember Rigardi making a similar comparison, I think, in Garden of Pomegranates, where he talks about how with the Western, in the Eastern way, you sort of clear away and you empty and you let go and you create this kind of clearing. And then in the Western, at least in the magical tradition, you just keep piling stuff up and making connections and linking and until you have this just enormous superstructure of everything corresponding with everything else, but it delivers the same sort of bang.
Right, it does. I joke and say, the Easterners strip away everything until they have a nervous breakdown, and the Westerners connect everything until they have a nervous breakdown. What we're really shooting for is that nervous breakdown. But
Now, you mentioned that, you know, do I do rituals and things like that? Don't get me wrong. I do rituals, okay? But I don't do them for the sake of just doing rituals and dressing up in funny robes and stuff. I do it for very specific reasons, and that at least I've convinced myself I know why I'm doing it. And early on in my magical career, so I've been doing this, okay, this Western ceremonial magic thing. I've been doing it since, 1972 or 73. And so at first, I do tons of rituals, and I had no idea why the hell I was doing any of it. I just knew that, well, this is what magicians do, you know. So I learned all these rituals, and I did it. And it truly, only years and years and years later did I see the wisdom in why I was doing that. You know, you hear so much about the pentagram ritual. And you think this is an ancient magician made up by the Golden Dawn, for heaven's sakes. It's a 200-year-old ritual at the very most. And but you don't know why you do it. At first you think you're doing it to protect yourself from God knows what. And but what it is really doing is making you comfortable in a specific magical environment. And the very first magical environment you want to feel comfortable in is this illusionary dimensional environment that we're in, where there's a north and a south and an east and a west and an up and a down. And you know, granted, it's not the most advanced spiritual environment in the world, but it's the one that we're wallowing around in right now, okay? And so the pentagram truly gives you it's like a master key to negotiating a three-dimensional universe where things are basically ideal things have basically manifested, you know.
And can you share like about that breakthrough you have where, I mean, because it's really interesting to me how people kind of mindlessly do all kinds of religious rituals all the time, and then there's the moment where you actually experience the ritual. Can you remember like a moment where you had that breakthrough where you kind of like really felt the pentagram in your existence in this space? Like, did that actually happen, or was it more like a slow accumulation?
Well, it was. I'm a very slow learner. I'm probably the laziest and stupidest of all the magicians that you would, you know, interview. But the breakthrough came. Yes, I do remember the breakthrough quite clearly, or the beginning of the chain reaction of breakthroughs. And that was the first time somebody that knew just slightly less than I did about all of this asked me a question.
Hmm.
Okay. Literally, I didn't know what the pentagram ritual and this whole, you know, mastery of the flat earth environment until someone said, well, why do you do the pentagram ritual? And in my attempt to explain it to them, I, for the first time, explained it to myself.
Hmm.
And that has happened again and again and again and again. And that's why, for the last 33 years, I've held a weekly magic class in my home. And it's open, it's free charge, and it's open to advanced adepts, and it's open to people coming right off the street. And every week I try to bring it all down to the very, very basics, so that it's understandable to the person coming in right off the street, and it's hopefully mind expanding for the person that has been doing this for 30 years.
That's good. I'm going to make one of these days. I'm in California. I'm not living in Southern California now, but that sounds like a wonderful gathering. I have a question also about your just sort of your general approach. I mean, obviously you are naturally a witty, funny guy, and you like even when you're talking about being when you were a kid, you were like the cut up and stuff. But it strikes me from my experience with hanging around magicians is that there tends to be a kind of a ponderous seriousness about many practitioners of the arts, and I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about why that's the case. Like, why are so many people who are like occult practitioners? What's that heavy vibe about? And two, why it's better to be funny? Like, what humor does in the like around that kind of stuff, which can be heavy or very meaningful or scary or awesome or whatever, but there's a role that humor plays. You're not just a class clown. You use humor very intentionally in order as a way to approach and integrate.
Well, first of all of this is very funny. And if you can't see that it's very funny, you're really missing a big part of life. Okay, this is incredibly funny, but at the same time, I don't want to say it's serious. It's incredibly profound. And the more profound the illumination is, the funnier it becomes. And I don't want to put down very talented, very knowledgeable, very evolved magicians that seem, you know, very serious and crabby. But I do, if they can't see how all of this is also joyous and funny, they're still missing a huge part of what this is all about. And it might not be a case that they're not seeing the humor of it and everything. They're just not, not really good yet at displaying to the rest of the world how funny they see it is.
Yeah, it's so true. I mean, there's a friend of mine, my friend Sarah Tenz, in the most magical, synchronistic, mystical moments we experienced, we just laughed so hard that we cried because it just is like so unbelievable that it's like you can't even stop the laughter from coming out of you when you see something so absurd and magical and completely, undeniably, coincidentally synchronistic. It's hilarious.
Yes, it is. And I really am grateful to the gods that I enjoy laughing at things. And I'm really grateful that I enjoy laughing at myself. And I get plenty of flack too from magicians and
for being funny.
For being funny. Yeah, Lon's a clown and you know, Lon is and I guess I'm just going to have to, you know, be prepared to take that because if you don't see that it's funny, then it certainly isn't funny. And if I'm somehow embarrassing a person and making them think that their spiritual worldview is being trivialized by my humorous take on things, and there's nothing I can do to convince them otherwise.
but I really kind of do feel sorry for them. And actually, I just finished a book that should be out in a couple weeks called Ask Baba Lawn. And, B-A-B-A, and then the next word, Lawn, Ask Baba Lawn. And it's about 25 years worth of letters that, are you still there?
Yeah.
It's about 25 years of letters that people have written me over the years, and my answers back, sort of like Crowley's Magic Without Tears. A few of these letters, of course, I don't use anybody's name, and I take steps to preserve everybody's anonymity, but some of the letters I've chosen just as an example of, I think, folks, this person has lost their sense of humor, because if people are getting upset about a magical trivia to that extent, these people really do need a life. And so I tell, some people just, now, you need to just watch more television and just, chill out. Watch more reality TV. Don't get into magic if you're taking all of this too seriously.
Well, it also seems like that the humor is also has a deeper, it not only keeps you from getting too serious and believing that all this minutia is completely important, or that you're the God's gift to the magical community, et cetera, but it also seems like it gives you a sense of the provisional quality of reality. That, like, if you see the humorous side of things, you see the way that things can be very heavy and very funny at the same time. And that's a good training for seeing that, like, that entity in the triangle of art is there and it's not there.
And
it's in my mind and it's not in my mind, or my mind is not what I think it is. There's some of that sacred paradox, which to me is one of the great things about the magical tradition. In particular, is the way that it plays on that edge. And I just wanted to read the subtitle of your new book. It's All in Your Head. You just have no idea how big your head is, which is great. And even we only have a few minutes left, I want to ask you a little bit about why you put that there, what that means for you.
Well, the book's called Low Magic, and in a way, it's that's a facetious title. Actually, what I'm saying is low magic is any kind of magic that you actually do rather than just talk about, but the subtitle is really the kicker, that it's all in your head. You just have no idea how big your head is. And there's always an argument about whether spirits and intelligences and demons and things like this are subjective things that are all in your head, or if they actually have a life and an existence outside of your head. My point is that in the final analysis, there is no outside of your head. And I use the example of the Kabbalists' way of looking at the world as being broken up into four worlds. And there's the material world that we bump our heads into, and then there's it's kind of a world of ideas or patterns, a blueprint world is just behind the material world, and behind that is a more subtle, a creative world, and behind that is just kind of like the life force itself, the only kind of true reality and the only true level of consciousness. And like if there's a chair in the material world, there's a blueprint or an idea for this chair that was in somebody's head, and behind that idea of this particular chair was the idea of just plain rest, a butt rester. You know.
Yeah.
So there's a material chair. There's the idea of the specific chair, and then even behind that is the idea of people getting off their feet, just that concept. And then behind that, at the very top, is this idea of just rest. Our souls are broken up in that same four categories, as the Kabbalists say, and there's our material body, and then there's our brains or our ideas, our imagination. But behind
Lon, that music means that we're going to have to stay there at that top level. running up the show. Thanks a lot for being on Expanding Mind. Lon Milu, ket.ning.com.